Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A new political weather has swept into Washington, D.C., and it's taken nearly everyone by surprise. Uncharismatic, aging, gaffe-prone, hyper-cautious, centrist Joe Biden has taken on an unlikely role, the leader of modern Rooseveltian liberalism. But back up a little bit. In the months before the election, the majority of the Democratic electorate was more or less united in its disdain for the Trump presidency. But what of the Democratic Party's nominee? Sure, Biden was preferable to the race-baiting neo-authoritarian in the White House, but who exactly was he? How would he lead? He lacked charisma, and in ideological terms, he was familiar, centrist, a Capitol Hill veteran with plenty of bad marks on his historical report card. And when he compared himself during the campaign to FDR and the potential of his presidency to the New Deal, who really took that seriously? Certainly not the left wing of the party that supported Bernie Sanders, and not too many others either. And yet in the first 100 days of his presidency, Joe Biden has not only taken on the pandemic with an orderly seriousness never seen at all in the Trump White House, he's also proposed a set of multi-trillion-dollar initiatives that bear comparison with the New Deal years. Infrastructure, in his view, is not just highways and bridges. It includes the future of the environment. It includes the education of our children. Goodbye the days of Bill Clinton saying the era of big government is over. Joe Biden may fail to win the votes he needs in Congress. He may run out of time and support. But he's waging a larger scale fight than almost anyone expected. Biden has set out to be a president of immense consequence. And maybe it's time we took that ambition seriously. Today we're going to take a look at an unexpected political phenomenon, the return of big government liberalism and its unlikely tribune. We'll start with Susan Glasser. Susan writes our column, Letter from Biden's Washington. So help us understand the general mood in Washington right now. We know that Biden's proposals are broadly popular with everyday Americans, but votes on these bills are expected to fall strictly along party lines. What's the general feeling toward Biden in Congress now?
Well, I think you nailed it in terms of, you know, the grip of polarization, if you will, and of extreme partisanship, while it exists in the country, has taken hold even more so here in Washington for a variety of structural reasons as well as personality reasons like the former president. But look, the reality is that it's breathtaking that they are pursuing an agenda this big and bold when you look at a 50-50 Senate. They are just one heart attack away from not being in control of the Senate. So the reality is that the window to act is short. The votes are not really there. And that's why any one individual member of the Senate has outsized power at this moment in time. You're going to read about Joe Manchin from West Virginia or Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona until you're sick of them because, you know, the joke around Washington, right, is that Joe Manchin is the Senate majority leader. So I think that's just a reality that it's hard to square, frankly, with all the kind of slightly breathless comparisons between Joe Biden and FDR, between Joe Biden and LBJ, both of whom had significant, very large majorities in both the House and the Senate to pass their legislative agenda. And it's also a political switch, though. That's the thing that I most wanted to say to you today in this conversation, is that it's not so much that Democrats have changed who they are or changed their ideology. I think what they've changed is their political assessment of what works and what doesn't work in Washington right now and what they're willing to go for and when.
During the debates, the Democratic Party debates, when Joe Biden would get a little misty-eyed about bipartisanship and reaching across the aisle and things like that, he was laughed at. He was called a sentimentalist at best. What is the state of bipartisanship and its feeling in the Democratic camp now right now? How are they feeling about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would like to say that to the extent he was seen as a kind of misty-eyed nostalgist in the Democratic Party, he won. And the reason that he did is because he was seen, I think, correctly. Biden was by far the most electable Democrat. And there is a concern, and there's an ongoing, I think, political concern right now that Democrats tend to get so caught up in their kind of progressive fever dreams and their conversation with each other that what they're doing is ignoring the reality of a country in which 40% of Americans and the vast majority of Republican voters do not believe Joe Biden was legitimately elected president, that we are in the middle of an ongoing Democratic crisis as opposed to one that ended with the election of Joe Biden and some mandate that it's hard to see where that mandate came from to enact a progressive utopia in terms of legislation out of a 50-50 Senate. And so my fear is that right now we're continuing to see now the Democratic version of an alternate reality that in its own way might create as many political problems as the Trumpian Republican version of an alternate reality.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment.
Hey, can you hear me?
Hey, Jelani.
Okay.
It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
Jelani Cobb is a staff writer and teaches at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Jelani, in his first 100 days, Biden's put forth three extremely ambitious pieces of legislation, the American Rescue Plan, the American Jobs Plan, and now the American Families Plan. Does the size and the scope of these plans seem at all recognizable coming from the Joe Biden that we've known for practically five decades of public life?
No, that doesn't really seem like the Biden that we knew or thought we knew. But at the same time, I think it's not necessarily that surprising because, you know, presidential platforms are basically best case scenario ideas. But nobody ever gets greeted by a best case scenario when they come into office. And so they wind up doing things that circumstances require as opposed to things that the hypothetical version of this person would do. And so I think that it's not what we expect from Joe Biden. But maybe we were wrong to have expectations to think we knew what to expect from Joe Biden.
No, Biden ran constantly reminding the electorate, the Democratic electorate at least, that he was Barack Obama's vice president over and over again. And I think not just because of the politics of race, but for to attach himself to all kinds of aspects of the Obama presidency. And yet they turn out to have radically different governing styles and different ambitions as well. What would you make of that?
So with Barack Obama, there was the kind of cautiousness and centrism that we associated with him. And it became, I think, a little bit more complicated because just being who he is, you know, he represented this much more insurgent movement, you know, the goals of the civil rights movement. But, you know, he was cautious. And then there were events that happened in the course of his presidency that reinforced that caution. The kind of Category 5 tempest that happened in response to the Affordable Care Act showed that they were not going to have a good time, an easy time getting anything through Congress. Joe Biden, I think, has a different situation. You know, they both came in after presidencies that people on the left and various parts of the left spectrum really despised. But Biden, I think, has not and been kind of caricatured in the way that Barack Obama was. Arguably, there's less to work with, you know, because Biden has such a long track record. He's been this avuncular figure in American politics, hewing toward the center of the political spectrum for decade after decade. Doesn't hurt that he's a white guy. And, you know, he is able, I think, to present his present version of his politics in a way that people find less alarming, even if they disagree with, you know, what he's doing or what he's saying.
You know, the fact is that I'm not looking to punish anyone. But guess what? You know, I'm sick and tired of corporate America not paying their fair share.
John Cassidy writes for The New Yorker about politics and economics. John, our national debt now stands at $28 trillion, and Biden's proposals would add another $6 trillion to that. So Republicans are asking the question, how much is too much debt? How do we know when we've hit that mark?
Yeah, I mean, the question of affordability is obviously a big one. I mean, societies choose what they can afford. There's no sort of automatic number where you hit a debt number and then suddenly the economy collapses. So if the country takes a political decision that we'd like to spend on the environment, basically expanding the safety net, childcare, elderly care, etc., the money is there to do it. The question is, how do we raise it? Biden, very political, is saying we can do this by just raising taxes on the rich. You've got to distinguish between two things. The Relief Act, the Pandemic Relief Act, which was just passed, the $2 trillion Act, which Congress passed in March, that is a deficit-financed emergency relief package. It's best looked as a sort of disaster relief to get people through the end of the pandemic. Then there's Biden's policy agenda, the Big Build Back Better agenda, which is different and is in two parts, the infrastructure plan and the social infrastructure plan, childcare, etc. He's actually proposing to pay for those fully by raising taxes on the rich. So if you believe the administration's figures, they shouldn't raise the debt at all because there'll be higher spending on one side, but there'll be higher taxation on the other. So that's not a deficit-financed plan.
So in other words, if you start taxing people who earn more than $400,000 a year, a good deal more, that seems to be, first of all, very popular in the polls. And does that represent a shift in public opinion?
You don't need to be a political scientist to think that's going to be a popular program, because people are basically being told that they can have these very valuable and popular programs, but the rich will pay for them. From an economic perspective, the question is, is that feasible? Is there enough money at the top of the income distribution to make all these programs financeable purely by financing the rich over the long term?
What's the answer to that question?
Well, there is enough there to finance, there's certainly enough there to finance a great deal more spending. Whether they can finance it all, I think, is the debate that's going to be had over the next 6 months or so as this stuff gets pushed through Congress. I mean, I think what underlies all this really as well, which we haven't really talked about, is, you know, he's always seen himself as a sort of defender of the middle class and defender of unions, etc., even though he's been criticized from the right for supporting financial interests in his own state. I think it's all a sort of attempt to reassert democratic leadership on issues of economic populism.
Create jobs to modernize our bridges, our roads, our highways, our ports, our airports, our water pipes, our water projects, high-speed internet, transmission lines, and sustainable housing.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University and a staff writer. So Jill, I want to ask about the historical background to Biden's agenda. He has welcomed comparisons of himself and his plans to the New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. So how does this historical moment compare to those two, to the LBJ moment and the FDR moment, and their cases for big government?
I sometimes like to remember how LBJ wanted to call the Great Society the better deal. People said, wait, that doesn't sound good enough. Like, I think Biden wants to offer up the best deal. But I mean, if you think about the challenges that FDR and LBJ faced, there's not a one of them that Biden doesn't also have on the to-do list. So, you know, FDR was looking at the Great Depression and racial injustice in both eras, but that was certainly on very much a matter attended to by LBJ and the ways that he attempted to attend to it. But on top of all of those very dire circumstances, Biden has to contend with a global pandemic and an opposition party that doesn't recognize the legitimacy of his election. So we can look at bit by bit the legislative initiatives he's undertaking, and the scale of them is enormous and is exciting and challenging. But they can't address all of these problems confronting the nation and the world.
How would you compare the Great Depression and the economic situation that we're in now as a monumental challenge?
I think This is maybe less challenging than the Depression. I think the real difference, and to be honest, I myself don't find the FDR-LBJ comparison apt or really helpful historically, partly because I just don't think the president determines the course of events. So we don't have the same American people that we had in the 1930s or the 1960s. It's a completely different population. You can't like put FDR in a, you know, Doctor Who's phone booth and bring him to 2021 and he could address the American people, right? It's the constitutive population and the way that ordinary people face these struggles.
Well, how do they differ? How do the populations differ politically?
I think our spirit of endeavor is really different, for one thing. One of the ways in which FDR was successful was by communicating to Americans that we were in the same boat. And, you know, we can look back at that and say, you know, he totally threw Black Americans under the bus. Like, there's a lot of ways in which FDR fell completely short of that. Absolutely. But it is nevertheless the case that he was able to persuade Americans that they were in the same boat because Americans were persuadable on that point. And that is not, I don't think, how Americans feel today.
Jill, in some sense, Biden is trying to advertise himself as a third era in modern American politics, I would think. In other words, the era, the Rooseveltian era, which extended beyond him, and the Reagan era, which even encompassed, in some ways, Democratic presidencies as well. What stands in Biden's way?
That's a great question, because I do think he is right that we are ready for a remaking as a country. I think there's a real appetite for that among ordinary Americans. I think Biden is doing what needs to be done to do the work of governing, but he is not governing as a celebrity. And, you know, that really is a Reagan-era thing, right? Like Reagan collapsed together the highest political and most powerful office in the world with the glitz and glamour of Hollywood and the neediness of the Hollywood celebrity, which I think was carried on by Bill Clinton, by Barack Obama, is the defining feature of the Trump presidency. And I admire how wholly Biden has rejected that. But I worry that Americans are so accustomed to that, that they think that's how a president should be. Like, I am quite sure that Biden will not have a podcast with Bono after he leaves the presidency. He just has no appetite for that, right? That's just not, like, I think he wants to wield political power.
I remember at his first news conference, Biden said that the 21st century will be a battle between the utility of democracies and autocracies. And we've got to prove that democracy works. How does Biden go about doing that now?
Democracy has to work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think you can't, you know, it's like one of those things, like, you know, you see I see these bumper stickers all the time that say, trust the science. Like, I'm sorry, science isn't based on trust. Science is based on evidence and verifiability and reproducibility. So democracy is not based on trust either. It's just not, that's a fantasy, right? Democracy is based on proving its merits by providing a way of life that is fair and just and allows people to thrive. So right now we have, you know, what is it? 70% of Republicans don't even believe Biden is legitimately the president. That's not a problem he can solve. That's a problem ordinary Americans have to solve. I think he's doing his best by not trying to, like, that's a place where he's like, that's not me. Like, I got elected, now I'm going to govern. Like, that's what he has to do. It's up to the rest of us to make democracy work.
That's Jill Lepore. And we also heard from Susan Glasser, Jelani Cobb, and John Cassidy, all of them staff writers at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. obvious, but with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing.
Or politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to turn things over now to staff writer Vincent Cunningham, who writes about just about everything, culture, sports, religion, and more.
They can't take you wrong, take you wrong.
Here's Vincent.
And we can't take it no more.
Yeah, in 2 weeks, one of the most unusual rap albums I've heard about in years comes out. About 40 different rappers and then another 30 singers, poets, and producers recorded the album together in the home of a former member of the KKK in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The album is a concept album about a long-forgotten piece of American history from 100 years ago that we all need to know more about.
Fight for every one of our brothers and sisters taken without cause. Fight for justice. Fight for safety. Fight for freedom. Fight for our fathers. Fight for all of us. This is our home.
One of the artists and sort of the linchpin of the project is a rapper named Steph Simon. I heard about him from Taylor Hoskin, a journalist who covers music and culture. Steph Simon has been on a mission to convince the nation that we should all be paying more attention to the rap scene in Tulsa. So, Taylor, what's Steph like?
So, Steph is 33.
Is it good, vocal? Is the vocal good?
He wears these wide-brimmed hats and these, like, suede jackets with all this fringe going on.
Okay.
He wears a lot of, like, crystals.
That's what this city is. We some stones, rocking, astrology people. We some energy freaks. You know what I'm saying? From the tears dead, I can see the smoke in the earth. I can see the
fire burning. I can see the kids crying because their mom and daddy. So he started getting into rap just casually in high school with his friends in the early 2000s.
My friends had a studio. Mm-hmm. And I would leave football practice to record with them, and I would just record them. I was trying to be like a manager.
So they're having a lot of fun, recording together, just, you know, silly, carefree, young days. And then his mom dies unexpectedly.
I'm a mama's boy. I didn't know how to grocery shop. I didn't know how to wash clothes. I didn't know how to pay bills. My car was in her name. I always knew if I got in a bind, I could call my mom's. And that was pretty much me. When my mom passed at 20, I used to, like, lock myself in these away from everybody ass, away from the world places, basements and garages, and I would just hide out from every secluded area that I could find in the city, and I'd just sit there and write, just to keep my mind off of it.
So it sounds like it turns from fun to a kind of serious art right at that time.
Yeah, totally. But unfortunately, trying to be a rapper while staying in Tulsa was just unheard of. It was kind of conventional wisdom that you had to leave and go be where the industry is.
It was like, how the fuck am I supposed to make it in rap in Oklahoma? And people from outside the cities will tell us, like, don't say you from here. Don't nobody want to hear nobody from here, you know what I'm saying? So
then in 2010, he's just kind of hanging out at his house.
I'm in my apartment. Can I say I was smoking?
Yeah.
Can we do that on this? So I'm just high, just having a me day, just a self-care me day. And I'm watching YouTube, and what was hot in the streets at the time in hip-hop was 50 Cent, and the Game was going at each other. Game, it was like, man, I ain't G-Unit no more. I'm starting my own record label. It's Black Wall Street Records. And one of his homies was just screaming, Black Wall Street. It's Black Wall Street. We ain't fucking with G-Unit, blah, blah, blah. So while I'm watching these videos, I see on the related search section to the right, Tulsa Race Riot, Little Africa, documentary, 1921 Greenwood, all these documentaries. And I'm just like, Tulsa? So I click it.
At the turn of the 20th century, Tulsa, Oklahoma had the richest per capita wealth of any place on earth. It was dubbed the oil capital of the world, the magic city, and the city of dreams.
Black Wall Street was the wealthiest African-American community in the country in the early 1900s. They had planes, trains, pool halls, hotels, motels, jazz places, you name it. It became wealthy because during segregation, people had no choice but to spend their money in the community. And it was the kind of place where if you showed up and you needed help to build yourself a house and didn't have much money, people in the neighborhood would help you build that house that you could go on to raise generations of kids in.
Right before dawn, as many as 10,000 whites descended upon Black Tulsa. Opening fire. There was a block-by-block battle throughout the Black community. They would force the occupants of a house out. If people resisted, they were murdered on the spot. The homes were looted, and then they were set fire to.
The entire 35-square-block neighborhood, which is also known as Greenwood, was physically leveled to the ground in this deadly massacre, after a group of armed Black men tried to prevent one of their own from being lynched, essentially.
I was so mad, like, why has nobody told me this? I'm 22, 23 years old, and why I never got this information when I grew up on these streets that they talking about.
And that's unfortunately really common for Tulsans. Even the city's current mayor didn't know about this history until he was 23 either.
I hated that. I hate that we didn't know that. I think it would have helped a lot of us, like mentally, if we knew. Like, even if you grow up in wealth, you walk different. Like, you talk different as a kid. Like, you carry yourself like you're getting ready to take on the family legacy. But us, we felt like we didn't have nothing.
Here in Tulsa, a tale of two cities. About half of the city's Black population lives in North Tulsa. South Tulsa is more than 70% white and has twice the median household income. Studies show that residents in wealthier South Tulsa are expected to live 11 years longer than those in North Tulsa.
Once I found out about the Black Wall Street situation, my lyrics got very home-based.
From Tulsa down to the city, we built a committee, you know. We killing beats by the plenty like we some young biggies. Treat your mind like a shovel. If you not deep, you don't dig me. Bubble
like soap and water. It went from never talking about Tulsa and trying to sound like I was from L.A. or wherever, to being strictly like, y'all gonna get Tulsa when y'all hear me, because we got something that y'all need to know where we from.
Under the street lights, riding through the city, ain't got no destination, but I got my dreams with me.
That's when everything started to make sense. I knew I wanted to be one of those homegrown, hometown hero artists. Like, where you from again?
New York.
So Jay-Z, Biggie, Fabulous, these are all people that represent where they're from very well. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I wanted to be one of those artists also. So
yeah.
It's funny, he mentioned this trope, which is so true, the hometown hero in rap, right? There's certain people that's like, they represent that place. And on some level, there's no way to fake that, right? You can present, you know, here's this region to the rest of the world, but unless you're also connected to that desire of the people back home, it doesn't work. You have to have both ends of it.
Yeah, that you have to really have this community swelling and lifting you up, definitely.
But he's like, by now he's like, he's got albums out that he's selling locally. People know him locally at this point. There are people that are fans of his, or is he just like kind of in the wilderness?
At this point, he's still kind of in the wilderness, discovering his sound. He's hitting the streets with his homemade CDs. Getting in trouble for loitering, trying to sell CDs in corner stores, getting kicked out of corner stores. But that was ultimately really great for him because he bumped into other rappers who were also pushing their CDs. And they were able to carve out a little home for themselves at this dive bar called The Sound Pony, which used to be a white punk rock heavy metal place. When somebody's performing, they're kind of in the middle of this circle with all their friends jumping around them, mosh pitting. They really created this platform where they were the center of the world in that one little slice of the city.
Hands up! Yeah. Hands up! Yeah. Hands up! Yeah. Yo! But this is the
So Steph applies for these major music festivals.
South by Southwest and A3C. And
but he keeps getting rejected. Denied, denied. No. No Steph here.
And I was like, I'm going to make my own festival. Like, I don't got to go to South by Southwest. I can do that right here where we at. We got a dope street, main street where we rapping at. I'm going to get all these venues. And I'm going to call it a festival and I'm going to organize it. And I'm going to throw a show.
He's never thrown a festival before, and he decides it's going to be called World Culture Music Festival because he's thinking big. He's like, I'm going to take on South by Southwest, you know? Like, it's on.
I went to Sound Pony. I'm like, hey, can I book a show on this date? And they like, yeah, that's cool. So I went next door to the next door venue, and I was like, hey, can I book a show on this day? And they was like, yeah, that's cool. And I was like, well, can I use the patio stage and the stage inside? Like, they're like, yeah, like, you're trying to do, like, two shows? I'm like, yeah, like a show out here and a show in here.
So he basically cooks up a plan to get a bunch of musicians to come to this thing.
I didn't tell the venues that I booked shows all on the same day because I didn't want anyone to second guess it. And then April 1st, I dropped this big ass flyer and it's like World Country Music Festival. And it's like 40 names on it. It's like three venues. And so the day comes and I'm just sitting there. And by 10:30, you can't walk down there. It's just like, and I'm like, what have I done? Like, I'm like, what did I do? Oh my God. I'm so used to crowds getting like that. It's a fight or a shootout. And so I'm starting getting paranoid because I'm like, I didn't do any insurance or nothing. Like, I just did this on some, like, you know what I'm saying? Please, I hope nothing happens. And it's just getting more people and more people. By 12 o'clock, I'm getting dizzy because, like, the rooms are spinning. After the night was over, the bars was like, hey man, let's do this again next year, same day. And it turned into 5 days long.
Wow.
Yeah, it turned into a whole week.
Put the time on the map. It's tired of hearing all the cap. They want to play to pull up at the math.
I mean, that's like this kind of sneak music festival. And the fact it got so crazy that he was worried that something might happen shows that he had identified something, right? There was a hunger for something that he had tapped into.
Yeah, definitely. That this was a city that had no hip-hop scene to that extent before, and that he's able to show that Oklahoma is here.
Right, right, right. Drop him off at Navy, this ain't what you want. You better hold step, don't beat me to the punch. How you gonna steal, then try to
stunt? My city was burning, they was eating brunch. I'm plotting revenge, rolling up the runs. But remember, Steph's ambition is to be a hometown hero rapper, and like you said, that's not just about getting his music, his friends' music heard in other places. It's also that you have to really be about the issues going on in the city. And because of Black Lives Matter, people start to pay more attention to the history of racism in the city. And then a particular fight starts to emerge in Tulsa.
The street is named after Tulsan Tate Brady, who was a prominent businessman.
In 2011, an article came out about a Tulsa City founder named Tate Brady, who is basically like the Rockefeller of Tulsa.
Big money guy.
This big businessman who built up the city. And the article exposes that he was basically a white supremacist. Surprise, surprise.
He was secretly a KKK member.
He was Oklahoma president of Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Tate Brady was a prominent businessman in the early 1900s.
And then in 1920, Brady builds a mansion house modeled after Robert E. Lee's right up against the thriving part of Black Tulsa that's basically outshining Brady's white downtown district at this point. Like, if you spend money on a mansion on a hill that is overlooking these Black people who are, like, flying planes in your face, and you're a KKK member, like, and you're also somebody who crafted this city, you're envisioning them not being there for long. Mm. The article kicks up this like big debate over whether to rename a prominent street named after him.
But there are concerns he has ties to the KKK and the Tulsa race riots of 1921, which is why many are in favor of a name change. But many
his descendants are defending him in the local newspapers, and he becomes this fresh new symbol of the white supremacist Tulsan that has been allowed to stay around unchecked for a century.
The council vote was split down the middle, 4-4. One of those no votes.
So Steph decides to jump into the fray. He writes an album about Black Wall Street. And at the same time, HBO has a show in production that'll introduce many people, including me, to this history for the first time, Watchmen. And all of a sudden, this event that even many people in Tulsa didn't know about is suddenly on the minds of people all across the country.
That's Taylor Hosking. Our story about Steph Simon and the history of the Tulsa Massacre continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I feel like a mastermind. Other half tell me stay humble. Really, I be trying. Really, I'm just tired eating TV dinner. So I had to go and shift the paradigm. Really, I just had to break the cycle down. Rich blacks all around. Hey, hey. Rich blacks all around. Rich blacks.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we're hearing the story of Fire in Little Africa. It's a concept album about the Tulsa Massacre of 1921. That attack was the coordinated assault and destruction of an entire neighborhood that was known as Black Wall Street. The death toll remains unknown even today, but the massacre stands out as perhaps the worst single incident of violence in the terrible history of Jim Crow. And it's being commemorated this year, the 100th anniversary, with documentaries, official events in Tulsa, and one very unusual rap album, which was organized or convened by a Tulsa rapper named Steph Simon. Taylor Hosking tells the story with The New Yorker's Vincent Cunningham.
So Taylor, when we left off, you said Steph starts rapping about Black Wall Street, right?
So Steph creates an album called Born on Black Wall Street that can sort of serve as his personal story of what it means to grow up in the aftermath of this massacre. And he decides he wants to shoot the cover for this album in front of this evil guy, Tate Brady's old mansion house.
I knew it was Tate Brady's mansion. I knew the history behind it, but I wasn't like being super woke on the issue. I'm just like, yeah, I'm about to stand out front of this mansion. Like, yeah, I'm black and I'm proud.
This mansion is modeled after Robert E. Lee's home. It's a very Southern antebellum style house with like the big tall stone columns on the porch mm-hmm. and the big like sprawling balconies. So he just pulls up one day unannounced and he's like, I'm just going to get these shots off. Let's rap. You know,
is he dressed like you told me, like a sort of new age cowboy?
Yeah, he has the wide brimmed hat going on. He brings his little daughter. And this car on the road starts to slow down as he's taking shots.
Oh my God, this, yeah.
And somebody slams on the brakes mm-hmm. and rolls down the window. And then he just hears, Steph, what you doing, man? Like, what's up with you?
You scared the shit out of me. Excuse me, you just scared me really bad. Okay, it's his friend.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought this was about to turn into a movie of Southern Gothic horror or something.
I know, right? Well, stay tuned. So it ends up being this guy, Felix Jones, who was in the NFL for a time and out of Tulsa for a while.
He retired, and I probably haven't seen him for a long time. He pull up. He like, man, what you doing? Like, and I'm like, man, I'm shooting the album cover, you know what I'm saying, in front of Brady Mansion.
So it turns out that Steph's long-lost friend, Felix, just happened to buy the Brady Mansion.
You want to go inside? And I'm like, hell yeah. Like, this you? Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
that's like the best
like,
version of like, this you?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, no, this is my house now. Let me show you around. So the two of them start, you know, going all through the house.
We go in.
They see what used to be the maid's quarters.
And we showing us everything.
The balcony where Tate Brady would have been able to see the Black Wall Street community. The kitchen where he eventually ended up killing himself.
Kitchen. We go in the kitchen. I'm like, this is creepy. We go in the basement. I'm like, ew. We go upstairs where he kept his workers and stuff. Like, it's like,
This place sounds so haunted.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is a, yeah, anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and so
I would not spend a single night in this place.
I know, right? Steph's like, listen, man, let's turn this place into the heart of our hip-hop scene. And Felix is all for it.
He was like, man, I want to start a record label with you, man.
Like, let's put a stage in here, let's throw a show, mm-hmm. let's set up some recording studios.
And let's do it.
So you're right, they sage the whole house down, get some smudge sticks.
We just trying to get all the spirits up out of this thing that we can and push positivity out of it this time. And we ain't come to riot or march. We want results. We coming to take your pockets apart. Taking control of the art. Taking control of the plot. The benefit we gonna reap as long as you play your part. Be no lame.
This is happening in 2018, and then in 2019, that show that had been in the works at HBO comes out, Watchmen. Mm. It's set in Tulsa and paints Tulsa as a key place for a story about race in America.
Right.
The show is a huge hit, and suddenly all eyes are on Tulsa. So off kind of in the horizon is the fact that the 100th anniversary of the massacre is coming up this year in 2021. And there are rumors of Oprah coming to town, John Legend, LeBron James, Russell Westbrook, all these celebrities that are interested in telling Black Wall Street's story.
And I was like, man, if they're interested in here, somebody's going to shoot a movie on this, you know what I'm saying? And then I was like, hey, I want to hurry up and get my album ready so it can be the soundtrack when the movie does come out.
And the city's feeling the pressure to look good in the national spotlight, so they start throwing money toward their own commemoration events that can facilitate tourism and make it seem like they want to restore Black Wall Street's legacy. But the city's actually been giving away prime Black Wall Street land to white developers in recent years and overlooking Black entrepreneurs that want that land. Mm. Like, if ever there was a time that Steph could get the entire nation to pay attention to Tulsa and its rap scene, that is now. And that's when Steph's friend Stevie Johnson comes to him with an idea.
Yeah, you tell me.
Stevie's an interesting dude with a PhD working for this big money nonprofit, but he's also really embedded himself in the rap community. And of course, because this is Tulsa, Stevie's idea came to him in a dream.
It was so clear, like very vivid. And I just started getting on my laptop and started writing.
Stevie's like, look, let's call on every talented rapper we've ever met in this city, in cities across Oklahoma, bring everyone together to Tate Brady's mansion to record a mega album together. And it's gotta be everyone, not just Steph, because that's really what Black Wall Street was all about, coming up together.
It just goes back to like the blueprint we already had. We gotta move different. We gotta talk different. We have to think different. And let people know, like, community really is the true essence of, like, becoming free.
So Steph, Stevie, and their artist friends decide to go all in on this project, which is called Fire in Little Africa. And if it works, then the whole nation could hear about the Tulsa rap scene. I get an email inviting me to come out and hang out with Steph, Stevie, and their whole friend group while they're recording this album in Brady's former mansion house. So I pull up to the house and it's this beautiful spring day. I'm like, this is incredible. Everyone's kind of like gathering, laughing, smoking, hanging out. These truckloads of equipment are pulling up to the house. There's like six different recording studios set up all around the house. There was a chicken wing food truck outside, TNT Wang's, that has menu items named after rappers in their scene. There was this legal marijuana business tabling in the living room with like the most official career fair ready setup. And the artists who weren't performing were making documentaries about themselves that could easily end up on a big streamer one day. Just like this mentality of, if you build it, they will come, you know? I thought I was coming to cover a community that I'm not a part of. But as a Black person, the walls just kind of started falling down in a way. I was circling up with people to focus group our creative ideas. I was giving out my Instagram, all these things that you're not supposed to do when you're there as a journalist. It was this feeling of coming home to a place that I never knew was a home of mine. It felt like home because I was realizing a lot of the communities I'm a part of in New York, spaces where I get to be around folks with similar backgrounds, like queer Black creatives, those communities are mostly full of people focused on their own careers. They're people who want to be with their own, be celebrated by their own, but they're also not always willing to sacrifice their time, resources, or clout for others. I was seeing how you can think bigger and feel lighter when you're surrounded by people who don't just want to like your photos of winning, but actually want to help you win because they see your fates as intertwined.
the same way you feel when you get back home is the same way they're gonna feel when they hear it. I wanna go back to Tulsa. They're gonna get the audio version. We're gonna paint that picture for them.
I think hip hop is gonna respect it. I think hip hop is gonna see what we're doing, the flavor that we bring, and they're gonna be like, yeah, like I fuck with Tulsa.
View. Like a fresh pair of penny loafers with the polish on it, tell them keep on shining. Like a diamond on your pinky when you sipping Pinot Greasy, tell them keep on shining. Yeah, yeah. Always knew you had to go.
They recorded 140 songs that weekend. 20 or so will be on Fire in Little Africa, which comes out in 2 weeks. And drumroll. The album was recently picked up by Motown Records.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, Black Wall Street might not be a physical location anymore. It might not be as big and glamorous and mind-boggling as it once was, but it's in the person who sold 10 t-shirts at a market. It's in the person who left their pickup basketball game early to write their business plan for a new startup idea or write a pitch for a book about their life. We're not the same, and I put that on my search
history. All of that's really incubating at this mansion that once overlooked Black Wall Street and was owned by a Klansman, and that Steph had the vision to turn into a real home for his community.
Picture this, Greenwood Ave, Redman's land. See the brilliance built by a black man's hand. It was for us, by us, false prop, plot us, hold up, try us, peg leg, got us, we radiate.
Fire in Little Africa, about the 1921 Tulsa attack, is out later this month. Taylor Hosking is a freelance writer and a podcast producer. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for this week. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.